When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest, comedian, podcaster, viral stand-up crowd work sensation, I guess is another way. I think that's like another qualifier now. Ian Fidance is on the show. And this is a good one. This is one of my favorite conversations I think I've ever had on this podcast. Once again, to get in touch with me, you can find me on various forms of social media at LeffordDamien. But if you want to get in touch with the show, hit up the email address, turnedoutpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, and he will get the message to me. There is also a TikTok page, a YouTube page, and Instagram page for this podcast. All those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those respective platforms. And if you go to YouTube, there is a video version of this podcast. It takes me fucking forever to edit this thing. So please, if you enjoy watching people talk instead of listening to people talk, head on over to there, the YouTube Turned Out of Punk thing there. That's it. Oh, if you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that we have this podcast that comes out twice a week. Sometimes it's two new episodes, like this week. Sometimes it's classics. It's all over the map. It's a mixed bag. But one thing's always the same. We talk about punk music on this podcast. This one, we don't really talk about music that much. So that comes up a little bit. But, you know, we talk. And people come from a punk rock background. Okay, sometimes I get worked. The Tiffany episode. Tiffany, not as much of a punk as was sold to me before the interview happened. But just tell your friends. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You'll hear about them in this interview, weirdly. I don't normally like it when they come up in the interview, but they come up in the interview. Naturally, I didn't insert it in there, I promise. You can find out more information at fuckedup.cc. We have a brand new record called Another Day. And on August 9th, if you are in Toronto, come on down to Emissions Records on Dundas Street West, and I will be there, and I will be selling a special Turned Out of Punk color edition of the Another Day record. It's on like Turned Out of Punk green with the other colors splattered in there, and so come on down, hang out. I'm going to be doing a live podcast there too. It'll be a fun time. That's August 9th. And before that, we're going to be doing a 24-hour recording session in the studio. And you can watch it. It's going to be live streamed. God help us all. Find out more information over there at fuckedup.cc about all that stuff. Well, not the Emissions Records Party thing. That you got to find out more information here. Or check out that social media stuff that I mentioned earlier. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, a huge guest today, Ian Fidance, is on the show. Ian is a stand-up comedian who has kind of blown up in the last few years, does a very popular podcast, Being Ian with Jordan, with him and another comedian named Jordan. I guess that's explained in the title there. And someone I did not know very much about other than seeing clips of him online and knowing that he repped punk and hardcore stuff. And it was actually a friend of the show, one of my favorite people in the world, Chris Estrada, that was like, you really should have Ian on the show and talk about all this stuff. And the way I thought this conversation was going to go before Ian came on the show versus the way it went is why I like doing this podcast, because I don't know everyone. I don't know everything. And I thought I had one idea of who Ian was. And then after doing this podcast, I just, as I said, it's one of my favorite conversations I've gotten to have on this thing. You can find out lots more about Ian because Ian is on various forms of social media. Well, I'm sure he's on various forms of social media, but certainly on Instagram. Also, you can go and see Ian live because he will be going on tour. Well, it looks like he's constantly kind of going on tour, doing dates, comedy dates. But there's a bunch coming up. You can find out more information over at punchhub.live/IanFidance. But I will also have that linked in the bottom. But there's going to be shows in Fort Collins starting tonight. Ian's in Fort Collins. So if you're in Fort Collins, go say hi to Ian. See, you heard the show today. Boston, Columbus, Cincinnati, San Antonio, Winnipeg, Cleveland, Detroit, Las Vegas, Chicago. Prior Lake? I don't know. Tulsa, Oklahoma, I know. Erskineville, Connecticut. Denver, Colorado. I know that. Tampa, Florida. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Toronto. We're going to be hanging out in Toronto in November. Anyway, you can find out more information over there on those dates. And a bunch of them are going to be with a comedian by the name of Whitney Cummings. And a date there is also with doing the Being Ian with Jordan podcast as well. But find out more information at punchup.live/IanFidance. This is why I don't actually read the dates out ever on the show, because it's much better if you click that link in the description. It'll take you to all these upcoming shows. I think that's it. Is there anything more for me to ramble on about? No, I don't think so. So everyone, please sit back, relax, and enjoy Ian Fidance on Turned Out a Punk.
Rip roaring, ready to go.
Ian, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course. I'm honored. This is amazing. I'm a big fan, so being here is really cool. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm stoked for you to be here. And as I was just kind of boring you with my story off air, I don't have to bore you with anything and get right into it off the bat, which is, Ian, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
I really got into Metallica. I saw a Metallica music video when I was in like third grade somehow. And the first album I ever had the choice of buying, the first albums I ever got for like my CD player were Lynyrd Skynyrd's Greatest Hits and the new Ace of Base album that came out because I was just this closeted little gay boy dancing to Ace of Base. And my mom was like, oh, he might like this, you know? And then I liked it too much and I couldn't find it. So I think she took it away. But I went and I got Ride the Lightning. And so through getting into Metallica, I would go to record stores and look up their albums and everything. And I remember they had Garage Days and it had Misfits covers and Cliff Burton had the Misfits tattoo and they would wear the Misfits shirt. And I'm like, what is this? This skull is cool. And at the same time, I was really into like metal. And there's a kid on my baseball team and he was from like a religious family and we would go to his room and we would listen to like Sepultura on like Volume Notch 1 and like Obituary and everything. And then we loved Danzig and I ended up going to an autograph signing of Danzig at the Cherry Hill Mall when I was in like sixth grade, and I connected the two between like the Misfits and Metallica, and oh my God, Danzig, everything's intersecting. And we get to the autograph signing, and a guy comes out and he goes, "Mr. Danzig will not discuss, look at, or sign anything Misfits related." And I was like, "Oh, son of a bitch." But he showed me, I brought my guitar, he signed it, he showed me how to play a bar chord, he hit on my mom, he wanted us to go on the tour bus, she didn't let us. I think he was trying to finger her. I was like, "Mom, my stepdad could be dancing. What's the matter with you?" But yeah, the Misfits are like the first punk band I ever got into, and I was just hooked and completely in love.
I've heard that he's actually like a pretty nice dude in on one-on-one situations.
Dude, he was so nice. He saw that I was like a little punk rocker, rock and roll kid, just criminally ugly. I dyed my hair blonde because I loved Kurt Cobain. Like, I got to give credit to my mom. My mom was like the cool. She brought me to my first concert. It was a Metallica concert. So she saw that I like dug music and was very cool with like dropping me off at a record store, taking me up to Philly to go to punk shows. And I was like 13 or 14. And I think it was she didn't want me around. So she was like, "If I just give him music, he'll be in his room alone forever," you know. But she was very good to me in terms of like giving me that kind of outlet, you know.
Well, I think it's as a parent now, I realize how awesome it is to see your kid get into music. Like, was your mom into music as a kid?
You know, my dad was, and we had like home movies of the three of us dancing in the living room, listening to like Bruce Springsteen or Steely Dan, and they were always bopping me around. And so I've always been a music guy. That was like something that connected my family. And my dad was like super heavy music guy. My mom would just put on what was ever around, but she was never like, she never got me into bands. But it's funny because my mom's friends tell me that she was like the coolest in high school and was like the hip, like 60s girl, and like had Beatles records and the Beach Boys. And she tells the story about meeting Bob Marley, and she's like so innocent and wonderful. She doesn't realize what she did, but she tells the story like, because Bob Marley lived in Delaware for a little while, where I'm from.
Whoa. And I had no idea.
Yeah.
The Delaware years of Bob Marley.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He lived in Delaware, and my mom's friends were like drug dealers, and they brought pot to like his house or something. And my mom was there, and she goes, "And you know what? Everyone wanted to, but no one did. And I was the one that asked to touch his hair. And it was so cool." And I'm like, "Oh, mom, you innocent angel." She was like, "He let me. He was so, we were laughing." And I'm like, "Oh, God, mom."
I did a podcast with my mom and my dad, but before my mom passed away. And I always thought my dad was cooler. Like, he booked bands in the 60s. He worked for like record labels and all this kind of stuff. But then my mom's dropping like, "Oh yeah, I went to school with The Haunted," like some super obscure Quebec garage psych band that I had no idea about, that my friend hit me up afterwards. Like, "No, dude, that's like a $500, $800 record. That's a huge, huge band." Like,
amazing.
I guess it's just because men are conditioned to brag about themselves so much more and to put that side of themselves out there so much more that, you know, moms just don't get the chance to kind of let us know, "No, I'm pretty fucking cool."
I don't know. I also think like something biologically, chemically happens through the process of becoming a mom that at least like the old school mom, I kind of feel weird about now how like moms are cool and hip and everything. I'm like, no, I feel like the second you have a kid, everything's about the kid. You stop being cool. You wear shirts that look like bandanas. You cut your hair short. You don't care about anything else. And you just become like mom, you know? And I feel like your past is like a cool person. It's like, "I used to be somebody else," you know? Like, it's like a secret life, you know? I don't know.
We live in a Peter Pan world though now, where you don't ever grow up, right? Like there's
completely
adult Disney people. I'm surrounded by records, like old punk records. And
bro, I have a Ghostbusters flag in my, this is my podcast studio. I have a Ghostbusters flag. I have these, like I have a Divine candle. I have records around. Yes. I am an adult child, you know, but also at the same time, I don't have kids. So I feel like, okay, I can kind of do this, you know, but I feel like there's a rationalization that comes along with like narcissism in a way of like when people have kids now, they're like, it was, I deserve to go out. I deserve to like do all these like fun mom things. It's like, I don't know about that.
I think that's probably like now this sounds like a conservative podcast or a religious podcast, but like that's kind of like the, because we were conditioned to try and produce good citizens as a society. Like you go to church, you go to the army when the army calls you. And
yeah.
And I think the 1960s probably starts in the 50s, but like you really see a breakdown in like what the role is as a parent. Like, what are you supposed to do with these kids? Like, I don't want to raise my kid to be sent off to die or
give
half his money to a church that would probably sexually assault them if some
like, you know what, the church, whatever, let's send them to the Boy Scouts, go into the woods with a single man is no big deal, you know.
there's these sorts of things that you're conditioned, or we were conditioned to do. And like you look at the Boy Scouts, you look at these fraternal organizations that you're supposed to put your child into.
Yeah.
Including organized sports. That's clearly meant to
totally
precondition you for military service if the time ever comes that your society needs you to rise up for them and take up arms. Like, it's just, it just feels like, yeah, like, what are we meant to do as parents? And I say this as a narcissistic man baby with toys and records.
Right, bro, now. I'm right there with you. Totally.
But I have kids.
And, yeah. Oh, wow. Here's the thing. I may be putting my foot in my mouth, but maybe it's just because I don't know. I feel like anytime my mom tried to be my friend, I was like pushing back. But anytime she was like, I don't care what you do, I was like, no, but I want you to. So I had this push pull. And I feel like when a parent is like, let me dress up my 4-year-old in Chucks and my things and give them a mohawk with dyed hair, I'm like, I don't know. I my idea, and maybe I'm just, you know, I'm speaking out my ass, is the kids should find shit out on their own. And then when they organically share, I think that's nice. But anytime a parent tries to push on their kid, I just go back to that rebellious, like, no, I'm doing what I want, you know. And then you said it's cool to share with your child. So again, I, as a single bachelor 39 with a cat, and probably speaking out of turn, and I would love for my cat to chill with me and listen to Metallica. So maybe I'm an idiot, you know.
Well, I think they did that in previous times. Like, you dress your kid up as a little sailor, or you dress them up as like,
yeah,
this thing or that thing. Like, it wasn't necessarily pop culture, but I think pop culture has become so fucking important to us, where like, people live and die by Star Wars and what some fucking new spinoff is about.
Right. Or
this is kind of, it's supplanted religion for people.
Yeah.
This stuff. And
yeah,
I think that's like a large part of why we kind of put it on our kids, because it's so important to us. And like, my culture being, I guess, punk, because that's all I talk about. That's all I fucking do, was definitely put on my kids. And it's interesting. My eldest kid has completely rejected it and wants nothing to do with it. He was raised at the most fraught time in my life when I was going through, like, I don't want to fucking do this shit. So maybe that has something to do with it. It's like, and yeah, I've heard you talk about this. It's interesting the effects our parents have on us that we don't see. And I certainly didn't notice them and see them until I had kids and realized the fucked up things I was putting on to my kids. It's
yeah. And you're totally right. It is generational. I think it is interesting. The older I get, and maybe it has to do with brain chemistry or living a life, but the all the defects that I resented from my childhood and in my mother, I then saw later in my life. And in a way, in order to reconcile and get right with myself, the biggest part of that was recognizing, like, oh, if I'm not perfect, I'm not unique, this other person is not perfect. So for me to imagine and want them to be this idealized version, I have to completely humanize them in a way. And I think, like, parents in a way are these giants, but they're just complete humans not knowing what the fuck to do and doing the best they can. And that was the best gift I ever gave to myself, was like the true feeling of like love and being like, this is who she is. This is what it is. And she's so perfectly imperfect and I love it and it's okay. You know? And I think like trying to recognize that within myself helped me to kind of understand that in a way of like, these expectations and ideals we have need to be dropped in order to just arrive at ultimate acceptance, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And I think that for me, it took having kids, and I guess people can reach that point, like you're saying, through different means, but coming to that, I think, is when you truly become an adult, because there's no more gods, there's no more masters, there's no more heroes that let you down, there's just people. And
yeah,
it changed the way I look at this fucking music stuff, because I realized that I had been filling this sort of dad vacuum in my life that when my dad left, with these fucking musicians, like, who became gods to me. So when they let me down in some way, I let it hurt me in a way that there's no way I should have, because this is like a stranger.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's interesting, because you brought up, you know, like kind of fanatics of making, you know, like pop culture or religion or a god. And I do think we deify people so that when they do have one singular fault, we are just so hurt and upset. And how could you? You know, I saw it with John Mulaney, because he was, you know, everybody's favorite and he could do no wrong and he was just so wonderful. But that was just the self he presented to the world. He's a real human with faults and, you know, demons and things that make him a human. And so when you just look at one side of someone, and then when they do a very real human thing, which is fuck up, you feel betrayed somehow. And it's just another lesson, like, no, it's not about you. Like, nothing is about you, you know? And I think, like you said, with the dad thing, me too. My dad died at 8. So I looked to, I mean, my grandfather helped raise me, but he, you know, wasn't writing lyrics about, you know, loss and everything. So when I heard these things, which is what drew me to hardcore, because, you know, I loved metal and I loved the rage it induced in me and this feeling of like, I just want to shake my body around. But the lyrics weren't things that, I mean, maybe like, you know, Master of Puppets front to back, I could like relate to this like insanity and like loss and everything. But, you know, listening to hardcore and hearing these lyrics actually spoke to me more than anything else, which I then used these. I don't know if I so much used the singers, but I used the lyrics as like a compass and a guide for my life, in which like I didn't have anything, you know?
Yeah. Like, I don't think it was necessarily the real person, because especially at that time, you could never really get a rounded version of who this person is like you could now. Like, yeah, you follow someone on social media, right? Like, you're reading a Q&A interview with a person and trying to get a picture for this human being. So yeah, it was this complete facade built on lyrics and soundbite interviews.
Totally. Totally.
And then it would let you down and I would be crushed but it's interesting how, like, you look at the moral compass you could get from these lyrics or the emotional comfort you could get from these lyrics. Like, these are things that a parent, in this case, a father, would be providing. And this is why, like, these people became so important. And When They Let You Down, how it did have this sort of completely unjust, but impact on you in a way, because it wasn't just an artist letting you down. It was this sort of role model letting you down.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I look at that in terms of jokes. You know, there's very few joke comics left. You know, Norm MacDonald, Harlan Williams, Dave Attell, Gilbert Godfrey, they are joke comics. They reveal nothing about themselves through their material. And that is such a beautiful thing, you know, in a way that you can just entertain and laugh, and then you know nothing about them, which I think is so wonderful. And I've gone down the route of like, no, I'm just going to bleed everything out. And I wish I could be like, here's a joke about getting your mail. Here's a joke about, you know, sidewalks and pedestrians. But instead, I'm like, here's a psychological feeling I have of despair through experiences and humor. Ha, ha, ha. So at the way I feel is – with my jokes, like, don't like a joke. I get it. That's like, you're right. You know, that's totally fine. I hate when people are like, you can't say anything or this, that, the other. It's like, no, you can't. It's totally up to you to not like it. That's how this system works. It's pretty good. It's been working for a while. But if you reject a joke I have where I am vulnerable and I'm discussing my life or an experience that's deeply personal to me, it's like, oh, wow. You're not just rejecting the joke, you're rejecting me. So a lot of times, you know, some people have the luxury of hiding behind the lyric or the song or the joke. But, you know, I've always been drawn to people that bleed and people that give, because the connection is so much stronger. But also it's so much more of a risk when people don't like it, because then it's like, oh, this is a complete rejection of me and everything I am, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the difference between being a singer in a band versus being any other musician other than everyone else having the real talent. But the fact is that your thing is putting yourself out there. So when they do reject it, they're rejecting not just the band, they're rejecting you as a person, because you're the mascot.
Yeah.
You're the thing that they're going to really hate. And you're the thing that will go down with the ship. Anyone else could join another band.
That's why I've always had a fantasy about, like, God, I wish I was just the guitarist in Maroon 5. You know, you just show up, you play, you're a millionaire. No one knows who you are. And you just hide behind this other guy and you make your money, you take care of your family, and you can live a life, you know?
Yeah, that's the dream, is to be like, I had Ronnie from The Killers on the podcast, and he seemed like he's having the best life. He's just like, yeah, man, it's fucking awesome. I'm doing this thing. You know, I was in a ska band once, and now I'm doing this. It's crazy. It's a wild ride.
Yes.
But it's interesting, because that's why the Misfits are not really a punk band, while they're one of the greatest punk bands of all time, is because they're not singing about real life. And that's what hardcore and punk was. Like, you look at the Ramones, you look at even before that with the Modern Lovers or the Velvet Underground or the Stooges, they're singing about
their television, Richard Hell.
Yeah. They're singing about what their experiences are and what they're going through. And the Misfits are singing about some, like, straight up He-Man fantasy shit.
Yeah, just like, I want your skull and Last Caress, which is like, is this a deposition or is this a song? You know, what is wrong with your head? But it's interesting, like, that is almost like rap in a way of, like, for a while rap was just like fantasy talk and everything, and then now, like, some of it is pretty much a deposition and it's very real life, and that kind of gets scary. Like, if Danzig was actually, like, you know, eating people's skulls and everything, that would be like, holy fuck. But there is something so nice about, like, I look at George Corpse Grinder and he's the most wholesome, wonderful person. And then he's like, this song is about a skull full of maggots bleeding from your cock. And then he's like, I love Funkos. I love teddy bears with my daughter. And it's like, I like that, you know?
But there's also that there's a side that wants the Norwegian black metal version of the thing too, that doesn't want the fantasy. You want to know that this is, oh, this guy's
real, really authentic.
Bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I think why drill is kind of like the black metal or the hardcore to rap music, because people are singing about real life shit and it's not necessarily a fantasy at all. And it's, yeah, terrifying. In the same way that, like, some of those hardline records, when you look at what those people were doing, are pretty gnarly. Like, they're blowing up fucking McDonald's and they're singing about it in a record.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's so funny, like, how the further we get along in life and just society and culture and humanity in general, it's almost like the facade of fantasy goes away. And then it's just all real. And you can look at it as like, oh, this is interesting. Or like, oh my God, this is like deeply, this is like such a hurting person to live this way, you know? But I also look at, I also look at like, you know, singers, you know, when you guys are writing your lyrics, they again, like you're bleeding on the page, and then you have to have that vulnerability and courage to bring it to your bandmates and be like, here's the lyrics. And yes, maybe it is about being molested, but that's a conversation for another time. Okay. Hit it.
I think that's the thing that most singers would say to their band, like, unless you're saying something horrific in the lyrics, and there's obviously some conversations that happen around language between Mike and I when we're writing fucked up stuff. But for the most part, it's, you're laying yourself out on the page, and I trust that you're going to be honest with yourself and thereby honest with the band on what you're doing. And yeah, like, it would be really hard to receive criticism on something where you're talking about being sexually assaulted. You're talking about some real shit that happened to you, and then have someone be like, well, yeah, could you use a little different phrasing? It would be crushing. And I think I don't know a hardcore lead singer that would put up like that, writes their own lyrics, and not everyone writes their own lyrics. So, you know, and that's also, I think, a different art when I'm singing Mike's songs to try and like find his emotion without ever talking to him, because we don't talk to each other, is there's an art to that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But like you're saying, there's like, now there's a push to honesty where there's like you look at Mr. Beast as probably one of the most successful people to emerge from this sort of era. He has some of the least traditional charisma of any person I've ever seen on screen. And this isn't me talking shit. I respect that hustle as someone who has struggled to try and fake charisma my whole life, that he's been able to do it without it. I am in awe.
I mean, he's like, carbon copy, like somehow Jeff Goldblum in The Fly intersection of like Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, a succubus. I don't know. It's very strange. Like, some, I think in a certain level of fame or notoriety or money in your bank account, you lose your soul. And like with some of these people, you just see a vacancy there that's like, oh, you're a husk. This is crazy.
He's also unnervingly tall. When you see him, it's like when they show the Muppets' legs in the Muppet movie, where you're just like, oh, I feel unnerved by this whole experience. And his height does that to me in a way. But that's what kids want now. They don't want charisma. Like, I used to be a VJ at Much Music, and we did the VJ search, and you get all these submissions. And if he submitted a tape to the VJ search, he wouldn't have made it past the first round of purging of who's not going to get there. But that's what people want now. They want that realness over that sort of like fake Carson Daly version of a host. No, not shit talking Carson Daly. He's a super nice guy with great taste in music.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've heard he's a complete sweetheart. What you just said reminds me so much of the, so you want to be a VJ contest, where, the one guy, forgive me for forgetting his name, but he was so well qualified for the job. It was so clearly obvious. He was the perfect choice. And then Jesse Camp came along. It was like, ah, and everyone's like, this is the guy. This is what we want.
And that shows you what happened to MTV as they constantly chased the guy who was, what's up, buddy?
Oh, my God. Yeah. And then they're like, all right, we found it. Now let's only have reruns of this
for eternity. Let's just kill this.
Dude, I blame Viacom for ruining culture because MTV was the coolest. And it was, I mean, dude, do you remember Three South? That was one of my favorite cartoons of all time. The Flaming Lips did the theme song. It was about these two like misfits that were going off to college together. They were like lifelong best friends. Brian Posehn voiced one of the characters. And I just remember MTV was such a culturally important thing. And then now it's like, oh, let's look at Florida Bama reruns for, you know, 12 days straight. Oh, what do you know? It's just The Office over and over because they don't want to pump money into original programming. You know,
it's wild. Like when I was at Much Music, holding something that was so beloved, and obviously as like a punk rocker, you reject these things at a certain point. But before that, it was so beloved by me. And it was like my outlet to the world, and holding it in my arms as it died and watching them just kill it. And we didn't have MTV in Canada. We eventually got MTV Canada, but Much Music was cool. Like they would play like Pansy Division videos, and they would have interviews with cool bands. And I like learned about so much stuff there. And then I was brought in to kind of like try and revive it. Like we were definitely chasing Viacom down a rabbit hole at that point.
Oh, totally. I mean, dude, that's another way I got into punk rock and metal and everything was a cable access video music show. This guy named The Tink was like this old biker lunatic from Delaware County, Pennsylvania, like Philly. And he had a show called The Tink's Vid Dream. And it was on after ECW on Friday nights. And me and my religious buddy down the street on the baseball team would watch ECW, then watch Tink's Vid Dream, and we'd write down the videos and songs we liked. And then we'd go to the record store after baseball practice the next day and just like listen to them and be like, this is the coolest. But that's how like I got into like Dead Guy or like Donuts or whatever. And because this guy would just play these obscure music videos and do these like insane dumb skits in between, and it was the best.
Was like, have you looked him up now to see like what that guy's story was?
Yeah, his daughter reached out to me because I talked about this on another podcast, and she reached out to me and was like, thank you for carrying on the memory of The Tink. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm honored. Are you kidding me? This is amazing. I want to meet The Tink. I want The Tink to be my dad. This is the best.
That's wild. Do you know the band Infection from Delaware?
No.
They did an LP and a 7-inch, and Sean from the band was a guitar player in Toilet Boys, or is a guitar player in Toilet Boys, who's married to Theo from the Luna Chicks. They are fucking awesome, like raging hardcore, super kind of negative hardcore vibes at a time when everyone's kind of going more positive, it appears. But
I'll have to check it out. That's how I got into Year of the Knife. I read some music review, and it was like Delaware Straight Edge, and I was like, I'm listening. And that's how I got into them. And then, you know, they went in like a very like metal direction, which I still dig. But Tyler Mullen's band Scarab kind of picked up where he left off with Year of the Knife. And I really dig them.
Yeah, the Delaware's like Turning Point's from Delaware, too, I think. Right. Or right around there. Maybe it's
around there. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's like, and J-Tree.
J-Tree Records, of course, yeah. My first job was at a record store in Delaware at a place called Rainbow Records. And so that was like the coolest thing in the world to just play records and hang out all day. And I got the job because my mom used to drop me off there and I became like buddies. I was like this little grommet and all the staff kind of would be like, oh, you need to check this out. Like that's how my cousin was – I used to go to his house and we would like, he was like a state champion wrestler and I was trying to wrestle and he would like teach me how to wrestle and I was so bad at it. But then he would like listen to the Wu-Tang Clan and I went into the record store and was like, I want to get this album. And this girl just covered in piercings and tattoos, knew that I liked like Obituary and Cannibal Corpse and Sepultura. And she was like, no, I'm not letting you buy that. You're getting this. And she gave me Victory Style 1. And I was like, okay. And then I just listened to that and like looked at the thank yous and was like, all right, I got to look up this band. Snapcase sounds cool. What's that? You know?
That's a wild compilation too, Victory Style 1, because it's Victory's like Hi-Fi and the Roadburners, I think, are on that too, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. And then like that, they had Catch 22, which was awesome. You know?
Yeah, that's right. Catch 22 was on there.
Yeah,
Victory's like, talk about something I would love to hear, like a 12-part deep dive podcast on the rise and fall of Victory Records, because
totally,
it's a tale, I imagine.
Yeah. And I remember when they started to like have like Atreyu and everything. That's when I was like slowly turning the volume knob down on my stereo. I was like, I think I'm going to move on to something else.
They put out that, what's that, the band that did Who Let the Dogs Out?
The Baha Men.
The Baha Men. They did a Baha Men record.
No, they didn't.
They had a Victory World Music imprint for a minute.
Shut the fuck up. Are you serious?
I feel like either this is a acid dream that I made up, but there was Victory World for a hot second, and that was a release on Victory World.
And it was just like Mark Anthony and the Baha Men. Shakira. That's amazing, by the way.
The Post Donuts World Music Group project. Yeah. What was the first show you went to?
It's so funny that the first like legitimate show I went to was at the Trocadero in Philadelphia, and it was the Pie Tasters, Catch 22, the Pilfers, and I went up with a bunch of seniors that like picked me up at my house. And I got stomped on by some like oi guy in the pit listening to the Pie Tasters. And I just remember this like boot coming down on me. It felt like a movie. Like I felt like, you know, when like it's a point of view of someone getting punched in the movie. That's what it felt like. But like this boot just, and I remember smiling so much. It was like, this is great, you know? And yeah, that was like such a cool experience. And Cooley Ranks was out in the line giving out like Pilfer's tapes. And we were like, that's Cooley Ranks. Oh my God, this is crazy. This is crazy. You know, it was really cool.
Yeah, I think the thing that struck me first about going to punk shows is that breakdown between artist and fan, where having been to like, you know, stadium shows prior to that, and where all of a sudden, yeah, like you're saying, they're handing out stickers to you at the crowd or selling their own merch or something.
Yeah, they're running to the merch table, you know, like they're helping out with like the anti-racist action booth or whatever. You're like, this is crazy. And I very much carry that with me in terms of, you know, like I love, you know, afterwards I sell my merch and I hang out, and you know, I feel like that kind of connection is important, because a lot of times you don't have that. There is a disconnect, especially that's why I like, you know, I'll play theaters and I certainly love like stomping around that huge stage and everything, but I love small venues that you know, the no barricade type venues that I play of, like where the crowd is like right up on you. And I like to kind of see everything. And my style is like very conversational, and I want you to feel like you're a part of it. And I totally get that from the music and scene I came up in.
Yeah. And it's interesting to watch that kind of happen to comedy where, and maybe it was like, I don't know very much about comedy history, but certainly there was that moment where you had people like Robin Williams filling stadiums. And I know there was certainly a circuit of comedy clubs, but I don't know if it had that same sort of DIY. Let's sell merch. Let's even make merch. Let's do t-shirts.
Well, Robin Williams came up busking in the park, you know, and he was famous for going through the crowd, you know, coming into the show through the crowd or during the show, going out into the crowd, which I think is the coolest. And he doesn't get brought up in a lot of conversations for, you know, some of the comedy greats. But I think his style was so, I mean, very much, you know, I find influence in it. You know, one of the best compliments I ever got was someone was like, man, you're like if Robin Williams was angry and on Four Loko. And I'm like, dude, I'll take it. That's great.
Instead of, I guess, cocaine, probably at a certain point. Would
have been. Yeah. They're like, no, we know you came from the gutter. Four Loko for you. I'm like, all right, yeah, thank you. I still have a scar on my knee from riding my bike over the Williamsburg Bridge, trying to open a Four Loko, like drunk. And I crashed my bike and I'm like all cut up. And I remember people running up to me being like, are you all right? And I'm like, help me up. And a guy helped me up and I ran to get my Four Loko because it was like rolling and spilling. And I was like, no. And some guy goes, you're an asshole. And like walked away. I was like, all right, whatever.
It's interesting looking back at that kind of like Sparks Four Loko Vice era as being like the roaring 20s of a time, like pre-fentanyl.
Yeah,
people were doing face drugs. Like it was a bygone era that we totally can't get back to.
Totally. And then now it's weird because, you know, they've gotten rid of the Four Loko and the Sparks, but now they're like, let's put vodka in everything. Yeah. You're like, whoa. Even in the water, they're like mostly in the water.
Yeah, let's just really fuck people up now. Like,
yeah.
Like totally no food coloring to get to warn people before they consume it.
Totally. I mean, dude, when I go places, I have to ask multiple people, like, is there alcohol in this? Is there weed in this? Is this ketchup weed free? You know, it's crazy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, the weed thing's been interesting as a parent now that I've got a teenager trying to navigate, because my mom was just straight up lying to me. Like, I did it once. I hated it. Never tried it again.
Of course. Of course.
Now I know the truth and I can't really hide it from my kids. So they know that I've been doing it. But the question becomes, are they getting it safely if they're going to get
it?
Because there's these carts now that you like, you know, the vape cartridges where you don't know what's in it.
Bro, it's crazy also too how, you know, I feel like a big part of punk and everything is, you know, like fuck authority, question everything. And then now like people that came up with that are like, no, the government cares. Let them regulate the weed. Yes, they won't have any nefarious things going on, you know, and they won't lie to us about ingredients. You know, I'd rather get it from a store than from someone on the street. It's like, what? No, the street guy's not smart enough to put pesticides in it, you know?
No, well, the thing is, especially now, it's so confused up here because there's so much fucking weed. That legal weed's being sold through illegal channels, illegal weed showing up in the legals. Like, it's just, who knows what's going on here. And you're raising a kid. You're like, oh my God. Like, there's mushroom stores here now. You can buy mushrooms.
Crazy.
There's a store in Vancouver. You can buy LSD, buy strength, coca leaf tea, coca leaf cola, mescaline, analogs and all sorts of mushrooms and an ecstasy analog.
Wow. Well, I think that's smart in Vancouver. Anything to distract from the fact that the real estate is the highest in the world and then there's just street people living everywhere and you're like, but at least I can get mushrooms at this store, you know.
Vancouver is and it's been like this for a very long time, that it's had sort of this reputation of being like, yeah, this is one of the realest cities in terms of the effects of drugs on a population in North America.
Yeah.
Because of that, that's probably why weed was able to kind of grow there, because the cops were just like, fuck it, we're not worried about that shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's crazy too that as weed becomes this less subculture thing and becomes like a very big thing in the zeitgeist, we're also seeing at the same time the treatment of humans just being completely left behind, and you have to like step over a legitimate person in order to go get your legal weed. It's like, that's, it's just strange how things are rot. Like ever. And again, like the government is like, get high, enjoy it, get drunk. We're putting vodka in the water. Here's the highest amount of THC we've ever put in weed. And at the same time, we are seeing the most human suffering going on of all time. It's just odd.
Yeah. There's a real question of where this is ultimately going. And I think ultimately it has to be legalization of everything and regulation of everything, because there's just, we've seen what the alternative is, and people will just keep making worse and worse drugs. Like when Vice put out that documentary on Crocodile,
it was
like, holy shit. There's no better argument for harm reduction than this documentary right here.
Yeah. I mean, harm reduction is so important, and it's, but at the same time, you know, it's such a tricky thing, because man, when you're feeling good, and then when you're not pumping the shit that makes you feel good into your body, you will do anything and say anything to get the thing that makes you feel good. And it seems to me that with a lot of the, one of the biggest aspects of getting right, getting better and growing is follow-up care. And it just seems like we're so close to being like, yes, we're right here with harm reduction, you know, but then when it comes to follow up, it's like, ah, you're falling through the cracks yet again. And that's so unfortunate. And also too, you know, with the legalization of everything, wasn't the lie that the taxes of this were going to go back into society to then help and grow? And it's like, well, where's all that money going to? That's strange, you know? Like, yeah, harm reduce it, make it legal, great, but then use that money to help the guy so he can get off the thing that he's doing that you're trying to reduce the harm from, you know?
Well, and that's something I really want to talk to you about, this, because I think the big piece missing is treatment of the root cause of what's making someone. And like you're saying, it feels really good. So I'm sure that's a huge aspect of it. But there's also probably a root cause that's driving the person this kind of behavior.
Totally. And
pandemic, since the pandemic, losing a lot of friends to shit. And just not knowing, and I don't expect you to have the answer, but like, what is the right answer? Because it's not tough love, and it's not, maybe it's not complete passive harm reduction, but there's also like a judgment piece that you don't want to put on this person, because that's probably going to make it worse. But just watching the sidelines as friends struggle with this stuff, like what's the best thing to do? Like in your opinion, as
I don't know, man, I think I can only speak through my experience, and I don't want to, you know, I never want to come from a place of like, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. There is a lot of power within self that needs to be accessed. And I think people only have a slight window to get through that space of clarity. And when you have that, it takes a combination of self-will as well as grabbing onto whatever hand is available to yank you through that window. And you have to have a trust that that hand is not going to let go of you on the other side. And, you know, you said judgment, and I don't think judgment is helpful, but I may be in the minority here in saying that I do think shame is important, because at a certain point you can, allow behaviors and actions through a lack of judgment by, well, here's an excuse. Well, here's, we don't want to hurt. We don't want to harm. You know, they're already in a bad place. And it's like, dude, the best fucking thing that ever happened to me was a friend that truly cared about me knocked on my door one night when I was living at my mom's house, looked me in the eye and said, look at your mother. She's going to go to your funeral. And you're going to leave her with nothing if you keep fucking up and acting the way you're acting. And that like shook me to my core. And then he looked at her and goes, and you're going to go to your son's funeral if you keep just forgiving and allowing this behavior. And, you know, there were some dark times and there were some resentments and there was some anger, but getting to the other side of it through long-term care follow-up. But again, like, you're only going to get help if you want it. You know, prayers and tears can't keep anyone sober. You know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it stop doing heroin, you know? And I, what really, really bothers me is how completely fucked the prison system is and how completely fucked the rehab industry is and a lot of harm reduction, because a lot of, you know, I'm of the mind that those jobs of people that work there, like prison psychiatrists, psychologists, corrections officers, you know, people involved in the prison population, people involved in dealing with like the lowest of the lowest society, those jobs to me should be incentivized and paid through the roof. So it's not someone that's just like, oh, yeah, I just fell back on it. It's like, no, I strive to get paid. And through that, what do you know? I'm going to be better at my job through helping these people, and not just like helping them because you're getting a paycheck, but helping them through long-term, you know, reformative care. And I was so fortunate that I lost everything and had to move into a halfway house, but well, it's called a three-quarters house, in that we didn't have in-house counselors. It was all self-governed. It was self-run. So we each had roles in the house, but we each kept each other accountable. And that was like a form of long-term care for me. And, you know, it was, they have a ton of them all throughout the city of Wilmington and everything. And it really, a lot of the guys that came out of that system, you know, as well as a thing called the Lyman House in Delaware, which was that was more hardcore of like, you're in this house. It is, you know, governed and run by these counselors. There's no phones, no women. You're all together all the time. And that's like a very much hardcore version of it. But it was long-term care. And it's just such a shame that when, you know, men and women come out of the prison system that turns them into a human animal for survival. It's just, hey, here's a slap on the ass. And by the way, you're not going to get a job because you're a felon. It's, and then we go, well, they're back in the system. These people can't. And it's like, no, man, you need your handheld to teach you how to live again. And it's like riding a bike. You have your training wheels and you have your dad's hand on the back of the seat. And then once you start going, you think they're still there. And then you realize, oh my God, I'm doing it on my own. I can do this. And I think that's so important. And I think that's something that's lost with a lot of this. And also at the same time, man, I said it, but it feels really good to feel good. And it feels really good to get the thing to make you feel good. And I put myself in situations where I was living in such a lecherous way and I didn't care, you know, I didn't care what I had to do to get what I got. I didn't care about behaving the way I was because I would just feel good again. But then when that feel good juice goes out, you're like, fuck, you know, and a lot of people don't care to get better. And that really sucks, you know, but also I don't know if those people know there's a way to get better, you know? So it's just confusing and tough, man. I don't have the answers, but I know that what worked for me, and it was kind of a combination of tough love to a certain extent and the will and desire to get better.
Yeah. There's like I think a version of society where we never made the prohibition of any of this stuff a thing. So you have opioids, you got cannabis, you got psilocybin mushrooms. You have none of the chemical versions of these things, and they're all somewhat regulated. People have access to them for treatments of different things. Like, I think we would have been a lot better off with that hippie holistic version of this thing rather than
totally this totally version. Yeah. And it sucks too, because once people see money to be made off of someone, they go for that instead of, like, I really think a lot of people get into certain walks of life or professions with a good heart, and then they realize, oh, it's a lot harder to make change. It's a lot harder to fix. I'm just going to survive, and I got to take care of my family. I got to get my paycheck. This is too stressful, and I'm just going to keep it moving, you know?
Well, that's like the book that changed my life as a kid. And this is, once again, I credit punk for introducing me to anything interesting, from Noam Chomsky to this, but like No More Prisons. Did you ever read that book when you were a kid?
No.
It was William Upski is his name, I think. I'll put his name in the intro, but he wrote this book, and it was like, you could buy it for like $7.95 from AK Press, and all the punk press places had it.
Yeah.
And it was this graffiti artist who had done a book prior to it called Bomb the Suburbs, like a white graffiti artist in Chicago. And obviously grappling with things that I think were much larger, but opening my eyes to stuff. But his No More Prisons book really kind of informed me to the fact that, like, oh yeah, this whole system's set up to fail. So you wind up back in prison, and you can do the job for pennies on the dollar that someone would have to be paid a living wage for in the real world. And that's, mm-hmm. that's the end game of this prison thing. My friend MVP, he's like a pro wrestler for WWE. And
oh, cool.
He like went to prison for 9.5 years when he was 16 years old for robbing a casino boat, did his time. Fast forward like 30 some odd years later type thing. He lived in Akeem Olajuwon's house, sold the house for millions and millions of dollars, had millions of dollars in the bank account, went to get an apartment, got turned down because he's an ex-con. And so that's as a millionaire, he's still dealing with this kind of shit. And it's like you're saying, it's set up to keep people in this thing forever.
It's and then it's not even set up to keep those people. It's set up to keep their children that way, because in, again, like I said, in order to survive in a prison environment, you have to have a prison mentality. And then if you don't chip that away to grow out of it, you're just going to raise your kids in the same feeling and environment and coping mechanisms, and that's not fit for a civil society in a way to navigate the world when you're looking at everything as everyone's like your enemy and everything is, you know, a fight. And it's just so sad that we've done such a disservice to society for the goal of a dollar, you know. And it's just so sickening and sad. And it you know, because I used to be a teacher as well, and I saw it all the time. And again, like, I grapple with the fact that, like, I really tried, and then I had to leave, you know, for my pursuit of my career. And also, you know, I would just call my mom every day leaving school, and I would cry. And it was just so sad seeing what I saw and dealing with what I dealt with. And I tried my hardest. And a lot of people get in there, again, like I said, with a good heart. My buddy, went to Afghanistan, and his mindset was, no, like, this is what we're going to help these people. They need help. Let's go over there and help. And he said within a month, he was like, I just need to do my job and get out of here. There's no way we can fix this. And that's what saddens me, is I don't know if there's a way out. I know that think globally and act locally. And I think that's important, to like fix your circle and fix the things around you and try to drop seeds and kind of, you know, attraction rather than promotion, like by living a life and people seeing that and going, how do you get there? And then sharing that, and hopefully that'll help them. You know, I'm very much of the belief of, you know, like, if I hold onto your hand and pull you out, you're going to grab someone else's hand and pull them out. Just like with the idea of, you know, navigating comedy in the industry, it's like, if I kick the door off the hinges and I'm let through that door, I'm fucking bringing my guys with me, because, you know, other guys have brought me through, you know. And I think losing that humanity in this weird isolationist way of, like, people find their community online now more than they do in their actual community. And I think that really does a complete disservice to us growing and evolving as humans.
But comedy, especially like the world that you've kind of like entered in as this very successful comedian, it seems to me like it would be like being a DIY hardcore band or having a DIY hardcore band mentality. And then all of a sudden playing in the metal world where you're dealing with people that don't necessarily see this. Like, not that, like, but like Louis C.K. did that fucking episode of Louis that's like propaganda for what America's doing in Afghanistan in that one episode where he goes over there on the USO tour and they end up helping the village find the chicken and all this kind of thing. And it's like sponsored by the U.S. Army at the end, right? Like, there's a side of this comedy thing that you're now encountering, which must feel, well, I don't know, like, what does it feel like? Like, I know what it feels like to be in Fucked Up and then all of a sudden be at a show hanging out with, I'm trying to think who, like, those worst people we've ever hung out with, Slayer. You know, I'm trying to think of like some people that I would be like, on a humanity level, I would never be in a room with
right
this vibe before. And that's kind of like, seems like what has to happen at comedy, in comedy at a certain point.
I mean, sure. But I also pride myself again in, you know, again, everything I learned in life came from punk rock and hardcore. You know, it's so important to me. You know, the values and the lessons and even like the criminal aspect of, you know, like never letting your friends fight alone or like, you know, standing up for your friends and getting stabbed in the back and how that feels. You know, it's like I have no problem sticking my neck out. And I think also because I built everything on my own and I've built up a fan base of people that fuck with me and know me and, you know, I don't really have much that you can take away. So I've got nothing to lose by standing my ground. And I'd like to think that if I did have things to be taken away, I still would stand my ground because I know me and I'd rather do that and lose it than go along with some status quo of what things need to be. And I've definitely lost out on stuff by rejecting the things I've been told to do to kind of get further and succeed, but I'd rather do it on my own way. And I do stick my neck out. And when I am in a place, no matter if it's with someone who's very, very more successful than I am or powerful or has more, I have no problem sticking my neck out and be like, no, I think that's wrong. You know, because I think when you just are agreeable to get something, you're a fool. You know, and at the end of the day, I like silly jokes. I like laughing, you know, so even if I disagree with you, I'll love to hang out with you and laugh. And then maybe you can see that not everyone that disagrees with you is a fucking buzzkill. And if we can get along and laugh, maybe I can plant a seed that like you might be wrong or what you're doing or saying or thinking is not cool. And at the same time, I always want to be proven wrong. Maybe I'm fucking off, you know, but I especially like being, I guess you could say like queer in the sense that I really kind of have navigated away from just being, it's like a double-edged sword. Like, yeah, I am bisexual. I'm a bisexual man. Fuck you. But at the end of the day, like you say that and people already have this idea of what you are and where you stand and everything. So more than anything, lately on stage, I've just been like, yeah, I suck dick and I date men, but I'm not what you want to call it. You know, like I always thought it was so cool how Kurt Cobain wore a dress and he's like, no, I'm a guy in a dress, you know, rather than like, yes, I am this thing. You know, I want to, my favorite thing to do is to play small towns and be likable and have people on my side and then start to let them know how I think, feel, and am. So when they pull back, I'm like, see, that's something in you. You liked me until you knew who I really was, you know? And I don't know. I think that's a cool thing about comedy is you get to do that. Well, but Kurt, above all else, laughing and funny. And, you know, that's the whole point of it, you know?
Kurt said in that interview in God, what magazine was it? But he said that if he had more courage, he probably would have been queer or would have been gay.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, there's all sorts of theories, obviously, about where Kurt's mind was and what drove him to the sadness that he had. And certainly there's people that speculate that it was grappling with sexuality that was in there as well. But I don't, like, I wish I could remember. Advocate. It was in the Advocate magazine.
Okay.
Like, I had a friend. I don't want to say his name, but there's like very few people it could be other than this one person. But he took a lot of shit when he went on Rogan from his punk friends.
Uh-huh.
And afterwards, like people writing him being like, why the fuck did you do this? Like, blah, blah, blah. And I know from my own personal experience, when I went on Fox News, like, even though I thought I was subverting it, people now just go, oh, you were the guy on Fox News. And no one sees it from the way I was seeing it at the time.
Yeah.
And how funny and subversive it was all being. Did you take shit after the Rogan thing, or have you taken shit from punk rock friends for any of this sort of stuff? Or do you kind of pick that vibe from some of the old friends?
I really don't. Because some people have, but I just am like, fuck you. If you think for a second that I would compromise how I feel just to get on a thing or go somewhere and be agreeable, then I don't fucking need you or want you in my life, you know? And people are always going to think what they think. And I have gotten shit for being like, he doesn't make sense. He's queer and he loves punk, but he thinks or feels this way. And it's like, yeah, because I don't ever want, you know, the whole point of comedy is a left turn. And I feel like I'm pretty good at the left turn in terms of like never knowing where I'm going to come from or whatever. And some people have their ideas and they can think a certain way, and that's totally fine. But I, again, like I would like you going on Fox News and being who you are, like if people don't see that, then that's on them. You know, like I would much rather have a larger national platform and stand up and say what I think than, you know, not do that as a fear of optics, you know. And I fall short, and I don't always get to say, again, it's like funny, like you got to make the quick joke and move on. You don't always want to turn everything into a dissertation, you know, but I fall short. I don't always say the right thing. I don't always do the, you know, wait a minute. Here's what I mean, you know, and sometimes it sucks. Sometimes you don't get that chance, but more often than not, especially in green rooms, but behind the scenes, because there's a lot of things going on and talking. And, you know, like that's a place where I found a lot of pushback and a lot of like, no, well, fuck it. I'll say how I feel, you know?
Yeah. Because there's certainly comedians that are quite open with some of their views that just from talking to you and hearing stuff that you've said, outside of comedy, I mean, just as like who you are as a person, seem in direct conflict with values that I think you have, or I assume you have. And you don't really see that as much in music, right? You don't really see like disparate ideologies kind of intermingling with each other as much in music, but I guess in comedy, it does happen a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. Chappelle, I've talked to Chappelle about this too, or Chris Estrada as well. Like people that come from this background and this mindset, and I guess there's a safety in punk that I've never been able to leave and never had the courage to really leave. And anytime I do, I'm like scared by my shadow and I go back into the hole because
what do you mean?
Well, because like I know for the most part, we all kind of have a shared set of values within punk rock. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say we all think the same, but there's just certain things that, and there's obviously crazy exceptions to this, but having done so much stuff in cannabis and in wrestling, you're interacting with people that don't necessarily have that. And that's not to say that people across the board don't have that, but it's just not the same as going to a punk show or a ska show or a hardcore show where there's like kind of a baseline, even for the terrible people that are there. Like they're not necessarily as terrible as some of the people I've met in the cannabis industry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, like, I'm constantly evolving, and I'm so willing to let you pump new ideas into me and to go, oh, yeah, I was wrong. Yeah, you're right. Some stances of mine change with more information and conversations that I have. I never want to be stuck completely in one line of thinking, you know, and I'm bisexual, I'm bipolar, and I'm bipartisan, you know, like, I don't know. I feel like I have so many conflicting things about me. And so I do have these like thoughts over here and then over here. And I try to find a middle ground with everything. And I do see myself as very much a middle of the line centrist, and I may be more right on some things and more left on other things, but I never want to be nailed down to one ideology or one party line along the way. And I think that is in contrast to a lot of people, because a lot of people like rigidity, and a lot of people do have some ideas about me that are completely way off. And it blows my mind, because I'm like, how can you know me and what I'm about and think I am a certain thing? And then I just have to be like, well, that's on you, man. If you want to think that, fine. But I know who I am. I know what I stand for. And if you don't like it, then fuck off.
Well, I know you're really pro-knife, and I'm not as pro-knife. So that'll be our first political disagreement.
Pardon me.
Believe me. I got a collection of cookeries locked away that would blow your mind. But at the same time.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Dude, some guy gave me a knife in fucking Eugene. And I'm like, thank you, garbage can.
you don't want to open that up and find dry blood a la, what is that? Paradise Lost documentary, or?
Oh my God. Dude, I watched that documentary because I read in 96 when it came out that Metallica did the soundtrack. So that's how I got into it, because I was like, whoa, Metallica likes this. I'm going to like it, you know? And then like that became so fascinating and something I was like obsessed with for years.
Yeah, there are examples of bands that have used their platform and really obviously in that case saved people, but like certainly lent their platform to something and had it benefit them. But then there's also examples of bands that have tried that and it just
does bro not work. I know. I try to be very aware of, like, you know, I've done a lot of charity shows and stuff for the Innocence Project and DCRAC in Delaware, which was like a lawyer based fund to help long term effects of redlining and everything. And, you know, I'm always willing to do anything with like drug and alcohol related or any sort of homeless or LGBT coalition. Like I've you know, and a lot of times when I do get a chunk of change, I, you know, try to find people to donate to their transition or like just blow and boost up anything I can to like help out some cause. But I also want to be aware of like where that money's going and, you know, how to navigate that as well.
Well, it's also like what you're saying there, it's like, yeah, there's you say you're a centrist and that there's certain things you're on one position of, but there's like certain things that are just like human rights shit and there's politics,
totally,
right?
Totally.
And human rights shit. But there's definitely comedians that are kind of anti-human rights with some of their shit and like some of the stuff that they're preaching. And that's the stuff that's always like that I find must be, well, I don't know. Like, what's that like to be up in a room with a guy who, you know, might not in some cases feel that friends of yours have the right to exist, or, and I've been in rooms with people that feel that way too. And I wrestle with this too. Like, how do we live in a society with people that are so anti society? Yeah.
And then, I mean, I don't know. I feel like sometimes things are better left unsaid, and it's not always the best to be combative and everything. And also, like, I am very much a thing that a lot of people don't agree with, you know, and, you know, I fight back against that. But at the same time, I not that I want to be like an attaboy or like a good boy or like agreeable, but it's like if I'm this idea of what you don't like and we get along, maybe that'll change your mind into thinking like, oh, he's probably not the only one. Maybe these other people are cool too, and I don't have to be so hateful or combative. You know, like, I'll never forgive Dave Chappelle for his stance on the trans community. I think he's just done such a complete disservice towards growth and understanding with, you know, I hate this idea of like platform and we have to be teachers, but at the end of the day, like, you can, for someone that spent five specials talking about trans people to not evolve a stance and use it in a way of like helping people understand that these are people and that they are not just a punchline and they're fucking privates. It's like, dude, grow up, man. And obviously you're into trans women. Just be honest. It's okay. 100%.
That's the thing that underlines a lot of these people is this fetish thing. And like, if for someone to go on for this long, it's like,
yeah,
clearly this is what you're dealing with. And yeah, you're saying,
and I've gotten pushback too, because I've been open in the fact that like, dude, he's prolific. He's a genius, but like, get the fuck over it, man. Grow up. Like, man, you have, for someone that's so obsessed, like to not have a nuanced opinion or a changing idea, it's very like, just disappointing, you know, to like go for that easy joke. And I've caught flack for my jokes about the trans community in terms of like, you're never going to please everyone. You're never going to win. But at the end of the day, like if you know me and you follow me and you know anything I'm about, it is that side of humanity. It is that side of fighting for people to exist and be accepted and be loved, and for the people that love them to feel okay about it. You know, it's like, I can't speak for anyone but myself, but I guess like my big thing that I've been like championing and advocating for by just living my life is like, you know, we always hear from the side of, you know, trans people, which is important, but for the people that love them, we're often ostracized as, you know, chasers or fetishists or, you know, these like perverts or just gay men masquerading as this. And it's like, no, I just love women. Like, I love women. And if you have a penis, that's fine. And if you don't, that's fine too, you know. And I love femininity. And the guys I date and go for are often, you know, feminine as well. And I can't explain it, but I also know I'm not the only one. And I want people that feel the way I do to feel okay about it and to not feel shame or hurt as if you're doing something wrong, because you're not. And I can't, like I said, I'm never going to get it right, but I can try and only speak to my experience with love. But sometimes I do get frustrated that people miss the mark on interpreting what I'm saying or doing.
I feel like that's the final frontier is human sexuality and truly honest understandings of human sexuality and desire and attraction. And because there's so much of society positive and negative that could be changed by just a better understanding of this sort of thing. Like, it's amazing totally. How many times the most hateful homophobic preacher, like it's a cliche, right, has come out as being gay or like,
bro, the amount of comics behind closed doors that are obsessed with my sexuality and how I navigate and everything is like, bro, I love you. Like, just tell me you're gay. It's yes. okay. You yeah. know? And like the hate I get from these fan bases of these comics, you know, like there's this very alpha movement in comedy right now that I, and it's sometimes people laugh, but I'm like, I feel like I'm a fucking alpha in the sense that I'm in touch with my feminine. I'm in touch with my emotions and sensitivities. And I think it's fucking alpha to be into poetry and to be queer and to own that. And I think to negate that or to just eye roll it like, no, you're just fucking gay. It's like, no, that's a fucking pussy outlook. Like, fuck you. And I get that a lot. And I really have to watch myself because I can get pretty combative with stuff. And it's frustrating, but I don't know. I'm gonna keep pushing forward with it. But at the end of the day, it is frustrating to kind of get shit from both sides because I'm not enough of this, or I'm too much of that, or I'm, well, because I do this, then I am that, you know. And it's frustrating, but I just got to keep pushing forward and being myself. And if you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. But it's not really my problem. But it is funny the hate I get from a lot of straight guys for being openly queer and not picking a side is very telling and interesting, which is why like I love subverting that and having people like me and then being like, no, this is who I am. And when you don't like it, that says more about you than it does me.
Yeah. Like it's fascinating looking at people right now and this sort of increasing emphasis on parasocial relationships that people have because of the internet and the connection to internet pornography and sort of these people's sexual attraction to these heroes, gods, deities that they've kind of built up through these parasocial relationships. Like there is, like you look at these sort of super cis hetero dudes that have this obsession with that Dave Portnoy guy and who he's having relations with and talking about his prowess. And it's so weird that these guys can't just admit what's happening and be happy and at peace with it. And instead like have to exist and try and masquerade under some sort of, like you're saying, like this false masculinity thing.
Yeah, totally. And it's so funny because it's like, dude, it's okay to have these feelings you feel, but recognize where the anger comes from. Recognize the visceral reaction you're having to the fact that I'm just existing and that other people are existing, but it's you're feeling that it's on your shoulders to tell people the truth of what it is. Like, no, you're not bisexual. You're gay. No, that woman you love, she's a man. And it's like, you're gay. You're a catty gay man. And also, your obsessive relationship with a podcast is very womanlike and very like gossipy. It's weird, you know?
It's weird, and it's sort of this like living vicariously through. So you see it a lot in professional wrestling fandom and with professional wrestlers too, where these people almost become avatars for someone to live through. I love going to wrestling matches and just looking at the fans and the way the various fans interact.
Bro, I went to a wrestling match a couple years ago. Is my buddy's bachelor party and we're all sober guys and everything. And it was so funny because I had this thing. I was like, dude, there's like gay guys here, black guys, Hispanic, everyone's coming together. There's like this, the darkest black guy I've ever seen with an NWO shirt. And people are like high-fiving and hugging him. And he's taking pit. Like everyone's getting along. I was like, wrestling is a way to bring everyone together in the fact that we all can recognize misogyny is the biggest thing we're facing, because when the women's match started, everyone started booing. And I was like, that's the great wrestling and misogyny is what's bringing everyone together, you know?
Yeah. And then you go to some of the women's wrestling shows also have a terrifying fan interaction for a whole other set of reasons.
Oh, well. I can only imagine. I can only imagine, you know?
And it's like that all over the world. Like I did a wrestling TV show traveling everywhere. And like you're in Japan and it's like that. You're in the Democratic Republic of Congo in Kinshasa. And it's like that. Like there's this sort of the poetry of the people. And well, look where Trump came from, right? Like came out of wrestling. Like obviously before wrestling, but that wrestling run is really where that Trump character was born.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is a character and I'll never forgive him for playing into it. And anyone that thinks he's out for anyone but himself is just fooling themselves. And at the end of the day, he's a fucking slumlord from Queens, you know, and it's just, but that also speaks to the hurt of so much of the population that they would look to a guy like that for answers. You know, like the whole QAnon thing is so sad because it's a bunch of disenfranchised people that were promised so much, given nothing, and just searching for a reason why. And instead of accepting the sad fact that life fucking sucks and sometimes you don't get a fair shake, and accepting that and moving forward is so much easier and such a relief than searching for these fucking boogeymen that don't exist.
Well, that would have been religion, right? They would have been at the church and been told that this is the devil or it's.
See, that's what I fight with, because I've had such a fucked up relationship with God and religion and spirituality. And I fight with these old fashioned traditional values and ideas of like, we need something to bring people together to go to once a week. And like, I do love the tradition of religion in a way, but humans ruin religion. And I do think there's so many beautiful things about Islam and Buddhism and, you know, even Catholicism and the lore of sainthood and the Beatitudes and everything. And I think a direction for people to live and a compass to live by is so important. And I think getting away from that, we're searching for other gods and other things become a religion. And then through that become a cult. And there's so many different cults that are existing that is not good for anyone. And so I'm very much for the people, for the person against the group, you know?
Yeah. And that's what I think punk provided for me in a agnostic kind of atheist way was the moral compass. And it didn't have to be, there was a lot of different moral compasses that you could follow, but learning about stuff from Propagandhi or learning about stuff from Pan's Division or Jane County, learning about Jane County, like learning about the bands from all over the world. Like it really was my kind of exposure in the same way religion would have been. And you did things in service to this thing. Like you made a zine and you would lose money on it. And why'd you do it? It's because that's what you're supposed to do for the religion. Or you put on a show where you're going to lose money on it. Of course, but that's what you did for the religion.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, the intersection of politics and punk is so important, but it's also important to let people have their own politics and their own ideals, because whenever like you start to all think as a group, I think it's, you know, doing disservice to your own growth in a way. And I always want to, like I said, like I love people and I dislike groups. And I think once a lot of people come together as a group, individual thought goes away and they just go along with what the loudest voice is. And I think that can really be a scary thing, you know? Oh,
definitely. But that's what religion is, right? Like that's totally what I think punk is. That's why it's analogous to that. And I think it is more positive because there isn't just one preacher interpreting right. the words of God. There's like,
right.
It's polytheistic. Like you could follow Jack Grisham as your chosen, you know, Blagg, G.G. Allen. There's definitely all sorts of deities.
I worship at the altar of G.G. Allen, brother.
I'm sure we've all met some people that worship at the altar of G.G. Allen.
Jesus Christ, yeah.
Todd Phillips is from Delaware.
Todd Phillips?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, he got his start with Sean from Infection and Toilet Boys, and they both moved to New York together, and Todd made Hated.
Interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah. I'm going to check out Infected. I'm glad you told me about them.
Infection. Yeah. They're awesome. They're fantastic. And like, that's the problem with punk rock is so much of it's dominated by these mega scenes that put out tons and tons of bands or had like a really prolific label that was fantastic at documenting stuff. But
yeah,
a lot of great bands were from these towns that didn't necessarily have giant scenes or huge scenes, but still had killer bands.
Yeah.
This has been awesome. And
bro, I've enjoyed this so much.
And we didn't even talk about punk rock stuff very much. We just ended up talking about all sorts of other stuff.
Which in a way is punk rock.
It's very punk rock. And, you know, Ian, anytime you want to come back on the show and talk about punk rock or other stuff, you're always welcome.
I would love that, man. This was such a wonderful talk and discussion, and I would love to do it again. I'd love you to come on the podcast, and I definitely want to see you guys when you play New York. And I have to tell you before I leave, man, you played such a pivotal part in my life when David Comes to Life was around, and The Other Shoe was a song of mine that I would listen to driving to open mics in Philadelphia and just screaming it on the way to get outside of myself, coming from my halfway house in Delaware. My life is in shambles. The only thing I had was comedy, and I would just listen to your album front to back. And it was just, whenever I hear it, it brings me back to my Toyota Camry, starting the car with a breathalyzer and then putting your album on and being like, let's go.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.